But I think what they missed was, I think once Juul started becoming a thing on like TikTok, Instagram with kids, etc., these things take on a life of their own. Mm-hmm. The beauty of organic, word of mouth, compounded, great growth loop type stuff is that it compounds and has a life of its own. And the downside is, if you're in a regulated industry where there's lots of people watching, where you can no longer say we're trying to stop this because, and we're not marketing the kids because you don't control your marketing anymore. Welcome back to Unsolicited Feedback. I'm your host, Fareed Mosavat. And this week, for part two, I'm joined by Penelope Talbot-Kelly, who is a GM at DoorDash. And this week, Penelope brought the topic of the big vape. This is a documentary on Netflix about the rise and fall of Juul, a popular e-cigarette company. We talk a little bit about their mission, about their evolution as a company, some of the challenges they faced from their investors, from public outcry about their product, and just talk about some of the lessons learned from this documentary, which surprised me. I found very interesting. And honestly, I learned a ton about the company that I didn't otherwise know. We also talk a little bit about the state of the career market, things we're seeing, trends in this more austere environment in tech, and some of the places where Penelope sees companies misstepping as they think about their hiring, and also for people as they're searching for new roles. We hope you find this episode interesting. We'd love to hear your feedback, but let's dive right in. Penelope, it's awesome to have you here, and thank you for joining us for the chat with Austin. But I want to dive in here. It's just me and you for the second hour, and want to dive into some of the things that you're interested in. I think first off, we don't normally do intros, but I think actually it would be great to have a quick, who are you, what do you do, and just a quick background on you, and then we'll dive right in from there.
Okay. I think about me having two careers, one in mining and metals and commodities, which is completely unrelated to my time in tech, but did that. And since being in tech, have worked at Series A, philanthropy tech, Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, moved to a private company, TripActions, now Navan. Now I'm at DoorDash as a GM. Generally speaking, all in the capacity of operations to some degree, finance, product ops, and also some product on the payment side. So that's what I'm bringing to the table today, Fareed.
Awesome. I didn't know you worked in mining and metals, so I have to ask a question about it. If you had to name like one thing that was the biggest change, shock, difference for you coming from that kind of industry into tech, what is it?
Great question. I have lots of opinions here. I think the speed at which the industry moves. And that probably goes without saying, right? When you're mining rock in the ground, that is 20-year plus projects. Whereas you go to tech and it's move quickly, right? We're iterating constant changes. That was the biggest change, but also the most welcome change because it often felt like I was watching paint dry in that earlier time.
Watching diamonds form, watching paint dry, exactly. But watching oil become something. Okay. Yeah. Super fun. So you've been at DoorDash how long now?
Almost 2 years, which is crazy how fast that's gone.
Yeah. And it's a pretty volatile time over the past 2 years, especially in the delivery space. And something we talked about before when we were prepping for this is the changes you've seen in the hiring market, employee experience, et cetera, around this time. I assume DoorDash has probably done some meaningful changes to its structure and workforce over that time period. Is that correct?
Yeah, we had a riff two Decembers ago. I think they moved quickly. The fortunate aspect is we haven't undergone many since, but we absolutely have become a lot more intentional with every single hire. And it certainly isn't what it used to be where teams were growing at X rate and you could expect headcount. It's a lot more scrutinized. And I mean that all the way up to the top for new hires.
Yeah. So this has obviously changed recruiting pretty dramatically. Like recruiting teams are smaller. It's a buyer's market, not a seller's market, so to speak. What have you seen on the recruiting side that has changed now that we're in this market where it's talent rich? There's a lot of folks looking.
Yeah, I think talent rich is definitely the right way to put it. For reference point, when I'm speaking about this recruiting experience is both from a hiring manager, but also speaking to peers, friends, family members, colleagues around just even on the job search side. And so recognizing we have a massive candidate market, right? Where if we open up a new rec at least from a DoorDash perspective, but I know it's consistent with other folks at different companies and different sizes, you're getting thousands of inbounds, thousands. Wow. And so no longer are you really trying to market your role. You actually almost have to be really strategic and ideally discreet about how you want to go about marketing it to get the right type of candidates, because everyone is, as soon as they see JD, they're applying to that. But I think one of the trends I'm noticing is that, and it's going wayside because we are living in such a talent dense world right now, is just like really paying attention to the recruiting experience. And what I mean by that is walking candidates through what to expect. What is non-negotiable? Who is the ideal person? Does remote actually matter or not? I'll get to why I say all this. Is there a case study? Yes or no? What time can you expect to devote to this recruiting process? Because what I've gotten feedback from, and it's been a consistent theme in the last at least 6 months, is that it's not unheard of for candidates to go through full cycles for senior roles and get the auto rejection email, not even a call to explain what has happened. And I think that is a direct insult to all parties involved with who's allocated a lot of time. And I should add, I'm assuming there's usually at least 5 or 6 touch points with the company, and candidates are putting in a lot of effort, but so is the company as they're trying to evaluate the best candidate to hire. It's not also unheard of, and I've heard too many stories recently of folks going through a full cycle and learning that, oh, remote is a deal breaker and that's not even on the table, aka goodbye. And it's also not unheard of to find out that you've made through all of the rounds, and by the way, we're now going to do this case study. And surprise. And why I say all this is when I think about recruiting, sure, that's a point in time where you're a candidate and you're a company looking for that right match. But this is a long game. Your career is not this blip in time. You want to be constantly fostering those relationships, even if as a candidate you don't get this job, or as a recruiter, this is not the right fit, because your network is everything. It is not something that I think you can disregard. And when I hear about these candidate experiences, it doesn't bode well for building those long-term relationships. And connected to this, in this type of market where it is so talent rich, I think your relationships are more than ever important. How do you stand out in that pool of 2,000 resumes when you're applying into a job description? Referrals go so far, and losing sight of how that network will come and help you at a future date, and or you can lean on it, and or you can provide service at a later time, I think is getting really lost, because you have thousands of applicants. You will find the right person for that role eventually, but it certainly is losing that human side.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because so much of the last era of tech, and honestly, this is like from a 10-year cycle, almost 15-year cycle from like 2007, 2008 through to 2020, basically, the problem was the other direction. It was we can't hire fast enough. We have to convince people to join our company versus all of the options that they have. And so companies invested deeply in fast decision-making, really solid hiring processes. Get a LaCroix when you come in. There's a nice little like area where you sit, like all these sorts of things. And now it seems like what you're saying, and I haven't had this experience quite as much on my side because I haven't been a serious job seeker in a while, which is just like, going back to treating it like a funnel and not treating it like a relationship. What impact do you think this has on job experience?
I think there's probably two kind of folks, and maybe I'm generalizing a bit much, but there are folks who have been out of work, right? Not by their choice for 6+ months. And so a job offer is a job offer and they're likely to close. Do I see a lot of negotiation or as much negotiation as I saw 3 years ago? No, I see less. I definitely see less. But then the second group I think are, and this is not to say one doesn't overlap, is top talent. I think top talent still chooses where they want to work, which only reinforces why that recruitment process and experience is even more important than ever. Because while finding your next big role, I do think top talent is talking to multiple companies. They have a strong network, right? They're being referred in and they will have choices to make. I think the other reality that I've also seen is because recruiting and onboarding were the first two areas or one of the couple areas to get cut quite quickly, you can lose some of that great first day experience, first week, first month, like really coming across together as this is how we're going to become successful together. But what's also interesting to note is the culture in which they're coming into. So we've talked a lot about the folks who have been impacted by layoffs. There's a talent-rich pool or talent density pool. On the flip side, those folks who are still working at companies who are working with less, right, or doing more with less, probably with fewer concessions because budgetary constraints, and also who have, I forget the expression, right? Oh, and it's survivor's sort of guilt.
Yeah.
But also recognizing I got to stay competitive in my own company so that doesn't happen to me. It's an interesting starting place for new hires to come because I think there is this, what I've been coining a bit of a next level burnout in the making right now, really as a result of the layoffs, feeling like you need to constantly prove yourself so that you're not part of the next round of layoffs for that company. You're doing more. There's less recognition as a general rule. I still don't think we've really course corrected since the perceived higher output of COVID by removing some of the commuting times. So we're now still expected to do all that output. By the way, we're also coming back to office 2 to 3 days a week. And so I think there's something brewing internally at companies. And I've talked to plenty of folks at companies as well, just to get a sanity check there. But there's something brewing. So when as a new candidate comes in, just close that thought, I think they're coming into maybe a less inclusive, let me give you all of my time to help you onboard, and maybe a little bit more of an undercurrent tone of there's so much to do. I got to work on and focus on my own shit. Maybe some competitive nature to that, which is possibly not the right culture that you want to reinforce, but it's certainly shifting. I see that in how much time folks are allocating to getting to know each other, or even just the riffing and Slack channels, or how well do you know your colleagues? Do you consider them friends? Yep. I think that would probably have shifted quite a bit since pre-COVID to where we are today. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because there's so much talk on, yeah, how do you grow your career in this era in constrained resources? We've talked a lot about both the impact of layoffs and the impact of AI, but I haven't thought much about what's the work like for people who are moving through. And I think you're pointing out a couple of different really interesting trends. It is not as free-flowing with comp and stock and that kind of recognition. We're seeing a pushback against title inflation and title growth and managerial opportunity, which I think is a good trend, but does create a challenge, which is how do I recognize great work? If I'm not giving money, not giving title, I might be giving more responsibility, but there's also an undercurrent of fear. And fear can be a good short-term driver of value and impact for people, but it's a really bad long-term one. People don't do their best work when they're afraid. And there's this, feeling of burnout, which normally you'd see in the previous era as churn and low survey results and the types of things that a company might pay attention to, but no one's going to quit a job. They're just staying and burning out. So what is the impact of that on your long-term productivity, effectiveness, culture, et cetera, I think is a really good question. And one that's probably quiet because we're not in the era of activist employee complaining and those kinds of things either, which again, I think is a good thing. Probably means a lot of this stuff stays under the covers.
Yeah, I think it's brewing. I think just as a general rule, some of the layoffs and reducing headcount in certain areas was likely a good thing, right? And then there's also the point of going a little bit further than that, where you're going to start to see this natural tipping point of employees saying, I actually can't do this much with so little. And expectations are still staying constant. I don't know where we land, but I can certainly see that is brewing. Not talked about a lot, right? Because you don't want to say to your boss, hey, I'm burning out. That might make you vulnerable.
Right.
And I don't know how this starts to show up other than employee dissatisfaction and maybe even mental health, unfortunately, being impacted quite substantially. Yeah.
As a leader in a company, the relatively big room, and I'm like, what recommendations do you have to people to identify and also mitigate some of these problems?
Yeah. I've always taken the stance where I've, and I do this at every place I work at, there's an open door policy I definitely lead with vulnerability, sharing sort of my experience. I think that opens a lot of trust and an opportunity for your direct team and their direct team. And it's a bit contagious in that to be able to talk openly and honestly. I think doing frequent engagement surveys is great, but I think even more important to that is actually reviewing those results as a group and then coming up with plans to put that into action and then also following through. The other piece is recognizing and talking about the reality of working with less and encouraging stack ranking priorities on a weekly basis, right? Yeah. So folks feel empowered that they're not supposed to carry the world and do everything as a P0. There are some P3s that we all can agree to go down at the bottom of the list. I think my general rule is to humanize it.
Yeah, I think focus is the essential piece of the puzzle here. It's about doing more with less, but it's about doing more with less priorities as well.
Correct.
So I want to talk about the thing that you brought up as a topic that I think is going to be really fun and interesting, which is you recently watched The Big Vape, which for those who don't know anything about, is the story of the rise and fall, I guess, of Juul, a e-cigarette company that was founded in the Bay Area and is apparently way more of a tech company than I ever thought it was. And you said you had some fun reflections on it. I ended up binge watching this yesterday, basically, in order to get prepped for this. And I have a lot of thoughts myself. Why don't you kick it off? What's your biggest takeaway from The Big Vape and the story of Juul?
I certainly wasn't expecting to learn what I did on that one either. I went in thinking, I think I know it. It's an e-cigarette company that went too big too fast, moving on. I don't think I truly understood and appreciated that there was such a wholesome, I think, spirit behind the founding of the company with the two co-founders who were smokers themselves, who really set out to solve the problem of using tobacco products and ultimately causing cancer and finding a replacement and substitute to that. So they really felt that problem. I didn't realize this or this really in good faith initial way of thinking about how to found the company. And it felt like also surprised me is a lot of the employees interviewed really believed in that vision, yeah. Right? And
it was a mission-driven company, like yeah. In a lot of different ways. And a lot of people really bought into it.
Did not realize that. Now, I will say, I did come away thinking the folks that were interviewed were sort of manager type level. I'd be really interested in if it was fully reflected with other levels throughout sure. The organization. But let's just say it's a mission driven. I didn't also realize how they went about marketing the product was so typical of the big tobacco playbook
yeah.
Of marketing, how sexy it is to use an e-cigarette, lots of vibrant colors, people are cool, you're cooler for doing this. And whether or not it was intended, it appealing to a much larger group of young adolescents and young adults.
Yeah, I saw that as the key turning point in the company. There's a moment when they decide to launch it. One, after a lot of typical startup story of trying and failing, it's a great yeah. Example of how execution and product is honestly, is not everything, but is so much of the picture. You can have a huge market, a great idea, and some initial concept of how you would solve that problem. But the difference between version one, the detour through the Pax Plume and the canvas weed story back pivoting to solving the original problem was really one of relentless design and focus, like yep. Of product. And there's so many interesting lessons there about how you can have the biggest market in the world and the best idea. But if you're not like intently focused on the little tiny details, you may never solve the problem. But the original sin of the company is like the initial ad campaign. And I actually don't think it mattered to grow it that much. It was interesting. They like fired the CEO after that ad campaign because it wasn't growing. I don't think the ad campaign is really what blew it up, but what it did is it just put this example up that when it did go viral, so to speak, and maybe they seeded that with the influencers, etc. But the fact that they marketed it as lifestyle was never going to let them say they didn't, if that makes
yep.
Sense.
Yep.
And it's wild. My number two lesson, I wrote this in giant capital letters in my notebook when I was reading it was pick your investors well. Holy shit. The board, they committed another original sin, which was they got a bunch of not real investors who weren't really that bought in necessarily to the vision.
Nope.
Just to money. Honestly, seemed like a bunch of casuals. They looked a lot like the Theranos like investor types, like the best money they could find. And I'll swear again, the investors fucked them, threw them under the bus, pushed them to grow really hard. And then in the doc, that older guy, the investor guy, was like, if I had known this was bad for kids, I wouldn't have ever done it. And it's like, but you pushed for growth at all costs. So pick the right investors. Like, it is wild how much this company's trajectory could have been dramatically different had they had the right board.
Yeah.
It meant they had to take tobacco dollars. It meant they were probably pushed really hard on the investment from Altria. It's just wild how much, like, pick the right investors. Otherwise, you're going to get totally screwed.
Yeah. The question that my husband and I were chatting about last night is, could they have recovered after doing that lifestyle campaign initial blast? I'd love to hear your thoughts because we were debating this.
I think it seemed like a really smart campaign. Like, ignore some of the like downstream effects.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. They got a really sexy looking product out in market, made it look cool, made it look interesting, made it look appealing. But I think what they missed was, I think once Juul started becoming a thing on like TikTok, Instagram with kids, etc., these things take on a life of their own. Mm-hmm. The beauty of organic word of mouth, compounded, great growth loop type stuff is that it compounds and has a life of its own. And the downside is if you're in a regulated industry where there's lots of people watching, where you can no longer say we're trying to stop this because, and we're not marketing the kids because you don't control your marketing anymore. A bunch of influencers on TikTok own your marketing, right? A bunch of celebrities own your marketing and those people are cool to kids. So could they have recovered? It was wild how much every move they made after that was viewed with deep skepticism once it started like really booming. Like, oh, you're trying to addict people more. And I think a lot of that was just like when you sell in a market where the incumbents have poisoned the well for 50 straight years, I'm not sure they could have recovered.
For me, that broke the trust.
Yeah. I remember hearing some people talk about how Juul's mission was to end smoking and me thinking at the time, that's total bullshit.
Yep, me too.
Like, because I didn't know anything about the company. I didn't know anything about what they were up to, like why they were started. I actually didn't even know that PAX and Juul were the same company, which I only pieced together, not through the doc, but more recently. And I thought it was dumb. I was like, oh, that sounds like the thing a big tobacco company would say to try and get away with what they're doing. And it's not even clear if the marketing campaign made a difference there. That said, I will admit something I don't admit often on this podcast. I was a decade-long smoker probably from when I was like 15 or 16 years old until I was 25 or 26. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit less than that, a little bit earlier. Before I had kids, I stopped. Mostly stopped.
Okay.
And quitting was really hard, like impossible. And to be honest, not really relapse, but I was an occasional smoker friendly casual smoker for a long time after that. And there were two things I saw with Juul. One is, smoking was totally socially unacceptable, especially in San Francisco, for a good chunk of time. Probably from when I moved back here in 2008, it was like there were smoking bars when I left in 2008. Wow. By 2014, when I came back, it was nothing. It was dead. By 2018, 2019, vaping was everywhere. So it was clear that non-smokers were using it. But second, I have no interest in smoking a cigarette anymore because, you know, I have friends who Juul, that kind of thing. It does fully replace it and it is way better for you. And so I think a lot of that mission is real. And I thought the documentary I expected to be a hit piece, I thought was much more fair than I expected because they did tell those stories. And I think they told the founder's mission story very well. And I think it resonated with me. it resonated with me pretty strongly. This stuff is bad. It kills people. And just telling them that they don't get to have the fun of it is silly. That said, I talk to my kids. I have teenagers. Vaping is rampant. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Smoking was dead in high school. Dead. Did not exist. And nicotine addiction amongst kids is way, 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 way up. But I don't know how you stop that. Kids like drugs, man.
I know. I guess it's if it's not vaping, it could be alcohol. It could be some other
or Zyn.
Yes.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I was young. You want to do everything you're told not to do anyways. So there's some reality. I guess just freed on that question of like, could they have recovered? My one thought is coming back to that mission driven of eliminating cigarettes. I think where there was failure and whether or not it was acknowledged and it just didn't show in the documentary was there is some moral obligation for how we do think about speaking about a product when there is so much scrutiny on big tobacco. And maybe that was a failure because if they had, it probably would have gone a lot differently. Maybe they wouldn't have gone some sexy marketing campaign, but maybe it was so mission oriented and so focused and naively, right? We're solving cigarettes. Why would we have to consider about how they're perceived as another alternative to cigarette? I thought that was really interesting to think about. And maybe it didn't do them service if they were sending, if this is true, they were sending folks into schools to go talk about their products. Come on.
That was weird.
That was weird. But, and how that timing actually played out, who knows? But I do think if there had been taken a little bit more understanding the severity of replacing A with B and what are the possible ramifications, I wonder where their governance was in terms of how they were thinking about it. Maybe that it could have gone differently.
Yeah, I think that the lesson, most people don't sell drugs. Let's be real.
Yeah.
But, you know, we sell engagement. We sell food. We sell things that have impact on human lives and those kinds of things. I do think that the lesson for me, the other lesson beyond pick your right investors, which was definitely one, was Joff talks about this as something Jeff Weiner talks a lot about at LinkedIn, which is vision to values, I think they call it there. But like starting with vision in almost every single thing that you do. And I think their original sin was like talking about it internally, but then forgetting to use it in their communication to the outside world. And that was obviously a huge mistake for the company and unfortunate. Now, would it have ever been a $40 billion company? And at that time, probably not.
Yeah.
But would it still be what it is today or more? Maybe it would. So my other notes, which I think are funny, I had one note about the thing about product that like relentless focus on product is necessary. Like you can solve the problem, but not good enough and it's not going to work. The other one is, is this one of, wow, their marketing really fucked everything up. Like great marketing, but like really it was an original sin that made it impossible for the company to work at it. I think the last is the kids getting hurt was like the nail in the coffin that destroyed the company. And even though they had nothing to do with it, it didn't matter.
That was massive. You're absolutely right. Finding out that the kids who are hurt by Juul were using a different product entirely. Right. That I certainly, when I was just following Juul from a distance, I had no idea that there was that connection. I just associated kids, hurt, Juul, bad idea, get that product off market. And how stupid of a company to have thought that would work. You're right. But that's an example of trust being completely eroded, not even giving them the benefit of the doubt.
So let's try to extend this out a little bit. What kinds of companies should be paying attention to these kinds of questions and be thinking more deeply about them as they think about their marketing, their go-to-market, et cetera?
I guess the thought I have here is, right, this is product replacing one that's heavily regulated. And the benefit to Juul was that e-cigarettes wasn't regulated. And so there was very little thought given to, at least from my take, of what does this look like 5 years down the road when it's not regulated and sort of things can take a life on their own. I suppose if we're dealing with any product that is a replacement to something that is heavily regulated and it's in the sweet spot of unregulated, is actually thinking through all the possible ways this could be perceived from the wrong perspective.
It's self-regulating. Like,
exactly.
What are the good reasons for this regulation and taking care of it? So some ideas come to mind. One is, and actually examples that have happened. One is, Uber, DoorDash, Instacart. I worked at Instacart for a while. And there's a lot of many similar things happened in the gig economy as happened to Juul, maybe not with such extreme consequence around use of labor, how it's treated, how much people get paid, et cetera. I think the other is social media and around the use of kids around it, which I think has certainly been an area of question or concern. Cryptocurrency is probably another area where actually I think the industry, I don't know a ton about it, but has done a decent job of self-regulating companies like Coinbase in order to keep themselves from running down the spiral and acting in antagonism with the regulators around it. I think there are patterns here, but I thought there was a quote at the end of the doc where the Wired reporter says, basically, it's your job to anticipate all these consequences and work harder to avoid them. And I will just say, as someone who has worked on, I worked on tips at Instacart at one point. And let me tell you, it is impossible to anticipate all the ways in which bad people are going to use your product and do sneaky things to your system to screw people over. It is impossible. And so I found that a little, I'm concerned if that worldview comes across that it is, maybe we've hurt ourselves in tech by pushing the genius narrative, but if we're going to be expected and held to the standard of being able to know every unintentional consequence down the line, it's going to be a lot harder to build stuff. And I worry about this for AI pretty deeply. It's full of unintended and unexpected consequences. It's a non-deterministic system by its nature, right?
Totally. It's hard to understand whatever thing is lurking behind the next corner because it's almost impossible to understand how big or small of an issue that would be either, right? And it's impossible, I would imagine. Although I think one way that could be beneficial is to still have an informed internal opinion of what you would like this product to do. Coming back to like really painting that vision and values, as you said, externally, I think helps you navigate situations like this when they do arise. Oh, we understand that Juul's purpose here is to eradicate smoking for all these health benefits. That might have given the public a little bit more leeway and patience as Juul was figuring things out and working with the youth and young adults as an example. So I think like a lot of companies these days are taking a stance, but probably maybe could take a stance of we believe in fair and equitable pay. And these are the values I'm thinking about even like gig workers as an example, right? And just owning the narrative before it comes to you and looks like, oh, it's a surprise and you're on your back foot reacting so much.
Yeah, there's a tendency, I think, when you're internal to reject criticism because that's the only way you're going to survive. You're like, our competitors' product sucks. The people who don't believe in us are wrong. And these are important values. I think one process that I've done is to do a little bit of what I call a pre-mortem.
Yeah.
Or they call it red teaming sometimes in security, which is try to attack the product, which is what are the things that could most go wrong in this major initiative? I think product launches are a great opportunity to do these for most people. And then for each one, stack rank them by severity of how badly they can screw you as a company. And then ask the question, what should we do before to mitigate? What should we be monitoring to see if this is a problem? And what should we do after if it's a problem? So some things you don't have to prepare for. You only do it if it happens. But you want to have the plan already. Because I think the other thing that happened is this company was just totally unprepared from a PR, from a regulatory, from a response standpoint.
Yeah. Yep.
Because they were running around reacting. They were just trying so hard to not die. And so they didn't have a plan. And I think having a plan before the shit hits the fan helps a lot with clarity of execution after the shit hits the fan.
Even if it's none of the scenarios you anticipated, you at least have thought through how you could sequentially deal with an event as a result. What you will be better off.
Yep.
Totally agree.
Yeah, like we did a pretty big pricing change at Instacart that I think we knew might be controversial. And so a big part of the process of that was, what are all the things that people might be concerned about? And okay, how are we answering them? And it's not just comms. It actually resulted in product changes that we made in order to make it a less contentious set of problems around tipping, service fees, delivery fees, et cetera. They had to happen, but you always have wiggle room in how they happen. And you have to find the places in the wiggle room that make sense. Yeah.
That's been consistent throughout my career. In the most direct term, we'll come back to mining and metals. I did investor relations. You're putting out press releases. You do need to prepare for comms, but it often would mean we might do things slightly differently. Product launches, totally relevant. Thinking through even with what we're doing at DoorDash, I lead the voice ordering team. We're working with AI, is thinking through all of the, I wish that wouldn't have happened, and what if scenarios, right? It's totally ingrained in sort of risk analysis of anything in any change we make and how it might impact customers and or future public.
Yep.
I agree. You'd be better off. It did not seem like Jewel understood that part and or had a strong muscle in that regard.
Last point on this. It's sad because the intentions of this quote are so good. But Mark Zuckerberg has done a massive disservice to tech with move fast and break things.
I was going to go there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Please tell me more. Well, what are your thoughts on this?
It felt like, and maybe I took it the wrong way, but it felt like the documentary was pointing some fingers of the demise of Jewel for moving fast and breaking things and using this tech ethos to apply to this product company. And I actually thought that helped them, right? Come out of the plume sort of debacle. They're now products being used for cannabis. Let's pivot. Let's like work relentlessly to get a better product where we aren't burning tobacco. I thought that was a strength of this company and thought it was a little unfair, but you're nodding and I know folks can't see that. Sounds like you had a similar take.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of the pre-built narrative is like Silicon Valley has this dark side that ends up destroying the world. And I think one, you're absolutely right. This product wouldn't exist at all if they didn't move fast. Now, maybe the point is some people think that would be a good thing. Like it would be better that they just died on the vine, meaning they never got a product.
Yeah. The FDA would have loved that they move slower.
But not really, because the FDA originally was like, this is great.
Go for it.
So like,
yes.
I don't know who wants that.
Fair.
Like it's very hindsighty.
Mm-hmm.
I think the second is the ethos of move back fast and break things is that in the earliest days and when you're trying to make a lot of changes, it's okay to make mistakes in an attempt to move forward. Mm-hmm. And I love the ethos of that. I believe in move fast and break things. I think the problem with break things is when it's used as a metaphor at a higher level, it looks like move fast and break society.
Yeah.
And that's not the ethos. And that's what it was pushed on. And I agree with you. I don't think moving slower was the answer here. Again, I don't think they are fully absolved of blame.
Mm-hmm.
You are responsible for your reaction to things, and I think their reactions were poor. But I do not think that the attempt to move fast and break things, or whatever they want to call it, meant that they purposefully skipped over a bunch of like obvious things that any smart person would have been able to see. And I think it's so easy in hindsight to look back at it and be like, they obviously should have thought of the children. And it's like, they probably should have.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, this is the number one thing that every tobacco company has gotten caught up in. And the fact that nobody was looking at it is a mistake. But I don't think it's because of move fast. I think it's just naivety.
Naivety. That's what I wrote down, actually. Was there, that was, I think it was at the founder's level. I was so mission oriented. It was almost as if, of course, we're going to solve cigarettes and nothing else matters.
Yeah.
I agree. I agree with everything you said. There was responsibility that should have been done in understanding like the gravity of this product and what space it was playing in. But move fast and break things, I think, help them get to the size that they were as well.
Yeah.
And also getting a product that people loved and that was safer.
It's sad that I feel like this one quote from Mark Zuckerberg has taken on a life of its own in the criticism of tech. And you see it in the conversations around AI. You see it in the conversations around gig economy. You see it in the conversations around social media. It is a comment about how to build and be an engineer that has been used as a metaphor for all the ill that tech has done in the world. And I think it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a scapegoat rather than the spirit of it is actually very different. Totally agree.
Yeah. It has been an awesome pleasure to have you here. Thank you for taking on some fun and hard topics.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Did you watch The Big Vape? We'd love to hear your feedback or any thoughts that you have. Join us on LinkedIn or subscribe to our newsletter at unsolicitedfeedback.co. Next week on Unsolicited Feedback, we're excited for the return of Brian Balfour as a co-host and our guest, Kieran Flanagan, Chief Marketing Officer at Zapier. Stay tuned. We'll see you next week.